This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. State Representative John Bison is seeking another term in the 62nd District. Coming up, we'll talk with the Republican running for another 2 years in the State House, representing Battle Creek, Albion, and several townships in Calhoun County. But first, Western Michigan University's Kalamazoo Autism Center recently moved into a new home. The location on South Westnedge continues Western's expanded efforts to provide services for people who are diagnosed with autism. Kelly Kohler is clinical director of the Kalamazoo Autism Center. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Give us the background on Western's Autism Center for Excellence, as well as the Kalamazoo Autism Center. Kind of remind people who have heard about this before, and for people who haven't heard about it before, kind of tell them what goes on there.
Yeah. Well, I'll start by giving you the history of the Kalamazoo Autism Center. Our professor, Dr. Dick Malott, actually had his grad students out at what used to be the Croydon Avenue School, is now Woods Edge. And they were working, basically doing the same kind of things that we were doing there. But the kids are only getting about 15 hours a week of what we call ABA services. And a lot of the research shows that 30 to 40 hours a week is really going to produce the best outcomes. So his thought was, we'll open a private center to supplement some of those services. So we started in 2008, and we opened a very, very tiny center. We were actually just renting a room in a daycare. So we've been there since 2008, and it's been super small. I think on average we've had about 6 kids at a time, and that's about the maximum that we could probably fit in there. It got pretty full. I think at one point we got up to 10 and were pretty much standing on top of each other. So then Stephanie Peterson, the chair of the psychology department, and the former chair, Wayne Fuquay, worked together to get a grant, not just for the Kalamazoo Autism Center, but just to actually become the center of excellence here in Kalamazoo for autism services. So that included not just services in the Kalamazoo Autism Center, but we opened a diagnostic clinic. We opened a service center for individuals on campus who have autism. We're working with adults or older individuals to help them get jobs. I'm probably leaving things out. We're training more behavior analysts who can work with children with autism. So this was much bigger than just the Kalamazoo Autism Center. They got a $4 million grant, and just one tiny chunk of that was to expand that center. And that's where the university bought us a new building, and we've renovated it. And now we are officially moved in and serving clients.
So kind of take us through, if there is such a thing, a typical day at the Autism Center.
Oh, yeah. So depending on the kids, so we have some kids who are going to be there 40 hours a week, which is really great. That's what the research says would be provide the best outcomes. But then we have some kids who are in school full days, so then they're coming to us after school, usually 2 or 3 hours a day. So typically, all of our kids are working one-on-one, usually with someone from the psych department, but we're taking applications from anywhere, really. But we really only need somebody with a high school diploma, and then we do a lot of training on how to work with the kids. And so they're working one-on-one with someone like that, and then we have someone with a master's degree and a board-certified behavior analyst, and they do all the programming. They're doing assessments and actually figuring out what the kids' strengths and weaknesses are, and from there writing a treatment plan and focusing on certain goals to see how we're doing. And they're the ones analyzing all the data that we're collecting. And then it's the direct care staff who are collecting data on pretty much everything that the child's doing while they're with us throughout the day.
So a very individualized program,
yeah,
for the student who's there, and you're trying to really tailor it for their particular needs?
Yes, very much so. And data collection is a big, big piece of what we're doing, because these are kids that are already behind in so many ways that we just don't have that time to waste. So we're collecting data on everything we're doing, and we're analyzing that data daily, if not more than that, to make sure that we're actually making progress on the goals that we're working on. And if we're not making progress, we need to start making changes as quickly as possible, because, again, these kids just definitely don't have any time to waste.
And you mentioned that there are some children who are there for 40 hours a week, but there's others who are coming there after school for, you know, a couple hours a day. What sort of things determine whether or not a student is there for, you know, the long haul, or if they are just there for a couple hours?
That's a great question. And a lot of factors come into play there. So when it's a younger child, 2 to 5 years old, they don't need to be in school yet. So we don't usually have a hard time getting them the 30 to 40 hours that they need. When we also have to deal with school schedules and things like that, it gets a little trickier. And then unfortunately, what the insurance company is going to pay for tends to become a factor. And the younger kids are more likely to pay for 30, 40 hours a week. But as they get a little bit older, the insurance company thinks that they should be in school, and during that time, they shouldn't have to pay. So they're more likely to get approved for about 10 hours a week. But it's going to vary, and it's going to vary depending on the kids' needs. We definitely, it's possible to get kids who are older and potentially pull them out of school or provide them services at home, before school, after school. So it's really going to depend on the level of the need for the child as well.
So what are some of the things that you might work on? Would language, for instance, be something that,
yes,
that a child might be exposed to in that,
yep,
in that setting?
That's a huge – communication is probably our number one focus for most of our clients. That tends to be one of the biggest barriers for kids with autism. You know, we know they also have issues with social skills and restricted interests and problem behaviors and things like that, but you can imagine if you don't have those skills to communicate, that's kind of probably where all those other issues come into play. So communication is probably our number one goal most of the time. But like I said, we're also working on those social skills, the play skills. Sometimes they just need leisure skills, like how to just hang out and, you know, occupy their time in a semi-functional way without getting into trouble or you know, things like that. We'll work on group skills. Sometimes we aren't one-on-one and we need to get kids working with their peers or sitting in a group environment so they can function somewhere like a classroom.
When you have a very young child, as you mentioned, that comes in there with autism, is the thought that you want to prepare them so that they can go to school by the time they've reached kindergarten age?
Yes, exactly. We tend to say in our field that it's our job to work ourselves out of a job. We want our kids to no longer need our services as quickly as possible. And again, that early intervention seems to be key. The sooner we can get them and the more hours they can put in, the more likely we are to get them into that school environment. Because once they get to be about school age, if they're not caught up to their peers, they tend to just fall farther and farther behind. That's why we have to work just so hard and so intensely to get them caught up.
But you will still continue to have kids who come in after school and you'll continue to work with them.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's some that are going to need our services throughout their lifetime. There's others that, you know, we just fade back on the services. Again, it depends so much on the individual child's needs and deficits. And again, I think a lot of that also depends on how early they get intervention.
And early, I mean, are we talking 2 years old, younger than that?
It can be. It's harder to detect a little before two, but, you know, we're getting it earlier and earlier. So and it's hard for parents. You know, if you have a 2-year-old or even an 18-month-old, to the idea of sending your child somewhere for 40 hours a week is a little daunting. So I think families are sometimes reluctant when they're that young and it's hard to get those services. But in the long run, it's definitely worth it if they can.
Is it tough to get a diagnosis at that age? I mean, are there things that a parent might look at and think, well, this could be autism, but at the same time, maybe it's just someone who speech comes a little later to them or something like that?
Exactly. It's very tough, especially if we're talking like, you know, an 18-month-old. If they don't have speech, that's not always the biggest concern at that point. But there are other things you can look for, like, you know, awareness of their environment, lack of eye contact, things like that. But it's still, you know, autism, it's growing. People are more aware of it now, but it's still one of those things that I think you hear a lot of, oh, he'll catch up, or, you know, he's just going through a phase. And you want to believe that, of course, and you don't want to concern any parents unnecessarily. But we tend to tell parents, like, if you've got that feeling in your gut, don't let that go, because sometimes people will just brush it off and say, oh, he'll catch up. It's not a big deal. And better to intervene early than find out too late that you didn't.
How old does this go up to? I mean, what are the oldest students that you have?
Well, right now our oldest is 11, but we'll take them. I mean, we really want to take them all throughout the lifespan. Unfortunately, in terms of service funding, insurance and Medicaid tend to cover up to age 21. So that's great because they've actually expanded that age. So we're excited to be able to take older populations now. But we all know that autism doesn't just stop because you turn 21. So we're also trying to explore ways that we can help older individuals as well.
What is the new location providing you that maybe you didn't have before that maybe allows you to treat students somewhat better?
Well, I think first and foremost is space. We're so excited. We were in this daycare. We were just in one tiny little room, and we had constraints just being in a daycare. The oldest child that we could have had in the daycare would be 12 years old. So that alone, we had some clients that were, you know, I said we have an 11-year-old, and their parents are starting to get nervous, like, well, what's going to happen when they can no longer be in this daycare? So definitely just increasing the space and the age range that we can take. But now we're really excited to be able to, we have some rooms specific for like assessments for severe problem behavior. We're going to set up some rooms specific to potentially teaching kids, you know, desensitization to go to the dentist or the doctor. So just the fact that we have more space is giving us so many more possibilities. We've got a group skills room. You know, we could potentially do some vocational skills training. We've endless possibilities at this point. We're pretty excited about all of the space.
You have both of your degrees from Western?
Yep, all three, actually.
All three degrees, yeah. Right. Okay. And was this something that you focused on from the beginning, that you wanted to be in the autism field?
Kind of. I'm not coming in undergrad necessarily. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was a psych major, and, you know, as a psych major, I knew I had to complete a practicum. And one of the practicum opportunities within the psych department is to work. At the time, it was the Croydon Avenue School, and so at that time, I kind of just fell into it. But after my first semester there, it was pretty much all over. That's what I knew I wanted to do.
What have you seen from your time as a student when you really started to focus on this up through now the first couple years of your professional career, in terms of the growing field of autism research? What are we finding out? What sort of new things have come onto your radar?
Well, it's kind of interesting because in the field of behavior analysis, we've known for a long time we could treat this population. But I think the thing I've noticed so much over the years is how much more acceptance and awareness there is about autism and about ABA services. Because when I started the field, it was kind of a known thing, like, well, you're going to have to go out to another state to even find a job. And even then, it may get a little tricky. It's hard to get people to pay for your services. Where now there's jobs everywhere. People are looking for BCBAs all over the country, really. So just the fact that there's so many more opportunities for people with autism and so many options and services available. We still have a ways to go, but it's grown quite a bit. And I think so many more people are getting services than there used to be, which is exciting.
Are we still learning more about autism itself? I mean, is this still a developing field in terms of the research and what we know about how it may impact any one person?
Absolutely. There's always lots of research to be done in that area. Our field in particularly almost thinks that we spend too much time on autism because we study just behavior in general. So sometimes our field gets a little mad that we're focusing so much on autism. But I mean, that's where the needs are right now. And there's lots of great research going on. And I think a huge area, at least in my interest, is verbal behavior and getting those kids to communicate and using the principles of behavior to make that happen.
Kelly Kohler, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Kelly Kohler is Clinical Director of the Kalamazoo Autism Center at Western Michigan University. Links with more information about the center's new location can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. John Bison won one of the closest races for State House 2 years ago. The Republican took 51% of the vote in the 62nd district in 2014. He's now running for re-election in the State House district that includes the cities of Battle Creek and Albion, as well as several townships in Calhoun County. John Bison, thank you very much for being here.
Gordon, it's great to be with you again. Thank you so much for the invitation to join you today.
Please reintroduce yourself to the audience. Tell us about yourself.
Well, as you know, Gordon, I am a longstanding doctor in the Calhoun County area. I have practiced with Joe Schwartz for a number of years. There was a time 27 years ago now when he tracked me down when I was serving in the military in Southeast Asia, and he said that he needed someone to help watch his medical office as he went off and did many of the things in the Senate. At that time, I came to visit him and was impressed with the community, brought my family back, and raised my family here. And of my four children, two of them have decided to return to Calhoun County, and two of them are elsewhere throughout the county. But I have been a longstanding physician here in the Battle Creek community, have not been terribly politically active until just recently. And so if you're looking for a professional politician, I'm afraid I don't quite fit that quality. You know, I don't fit that classification. I've been there in Lansing now for 2 years, looking to go back to Lansing.
And if you do go back to Lansing, what would you hope to accomplish in those next 2 years?
One of the reasons that I gave up, for the most part, my medical practice was so that we could transform healthcare. Healthcare is my background. A few years back, I think I may have told you the story of how I was president of the State Medical Society, and that allowed me to walk into legislative offices and say, I represent 17,000 Michigan physicians. I thought that that would allow some of the legislators to say, well, maybe this person knows a little bit about healthcare. But the answer I got back most often in most of the offices was, well, this is all fine and good, but let me check with Roger and I'll get back with you on whatever the topic was of the day. Roger, of course, was Roger Kahn. He was a cardiologist. He was chair of appropriations in the Senate. He was one of theirs, and it became very, very obvious to me that if we wanted to make changes in healthcare, that I wouldn't be able to come in as a visitor, as being perceived as a lobbyist, in order to change healthcare. If I wanted to change the system, I would have to go there, roll up my sleeves, and do the work. And so that's what we have done for the last 2 years. We have done the work, and I feel that our healthcare system is something that desperately needs change. That right now we are spending at the federal level $1 trillion more than we have every year. We have a federal deficit of $19 trillion now. And I don't know how many dollars even $1 trillion is. It, you know, they talk about stacking dollar bills to the moon and back when you talk about how much $1 trillion is. And now we have, what, $19 trillion in a federal deficit? We spend about $3 trillion on our Medicare and Medicaid programs. And, you know, we can't afford it. We are spending the legacies of our children and our grandchildren. And we need to do better in healthcare. And I believe that I have the expertise to help with that transition.
So is there something you've done in the last 2 years you can point to that has helped Michigan's healthcare system?
I can point to something in the last 2 years. We have introduced a biosimilars bill that got stuck over on the Senate side.
What is that?
Biosimilars is like a generic for the new biologic agents. Many of the new drugs that are coming out these days are drugs that are made by living cells, be they bacterial, viral, human, but even insulin is now being transformed into something that previously may have come from manufacturing to something that is being produced by living agents. We see that these new drugs are life-changing in many cases, but by the same token, they are excessively expensive. You could spend anywhere from $2,000 to $10,000 a month on these new biologic agents. Biosimilars are medications that are similar to the original biologic drug with many of the same effects, and we need to be able to utilize them in helping to control the costs of healthcare.
So what would you do more broadly on the state level? Probably the area where the state can have the greatest influence on healthcare is in Medicaid. So what changes would you make there?
I think in our Medicaid program, we need to have pilot programs to see what works. One of the things that perhaps distresses me is the fact that we spend 40% of our entire budget, 40% of every dollar this state spends is on our Medicaid system. And, you know, on December 31st, I take a look and see what that $25 billion has gotten us. And I see a population that is not any healthier, that isn't any thinner, isn't any more active, doesn't have their blood pressure under any better control than it did a year previously. And the rates of diabetes are up. Obesity in our children is just as bad or increasing, according to the governor's dashboard that he has. There are just a lot of medical problems that even though we throw a ton of money at the Medicare program, we don't get to being a healthier state. And what we need to do is we need to transform to become that healthier state. We need pilot programs, Gordon.
I want to read something from your website. It says, cuts to our public safety threaten to lengthen emergency response times and pull police off our neighborhood streets. Our firefighters, law enforcement, and emergency personnel should have the funding they need to keep our communities and our families safe. And I just imagine right now that if I had some mayors and township officials here in the studio, they would say, that sounds great, Representative Bison. When can we see more local revenue sharing dollars so we can make sure that we have enough police and emergency responders to bring response times down?
That's an excellent question, Gordon. Thank you very much for asking that. You know, there are only so many dollars available in Lansing. And, you know, when you spend 40% of your entire budget on healthcare, I would argue that there are lots of dollars there that we can use better, especially when I experience the frustration of not getting to the place where we need to be in healthcare. You know, if we didn't spend so much money on healthcare, we would have money for revenue sharing, we'd have more money for education, we'd have more money for roads, we'd have more money for all the other portions of our budget. And it all depends on how you prioritize those dollars. And I would argue that we need to do things better. We need to do corrections better. We need to do education better. And when we get down to better policy, we will be doing things better as a state. And that's not that we haven't done things better, because you take a look at our economy in Michigan, and it is at a 15-year low in unemployment. If you take a look at where we were 6 years ago, middle of recession, with unemployment being, what, 14.5%, 15%, Michigan being one of the worst states in the nation, and look at where we are now with our rates being below the national average. And if you take a look at Kalamazoo and Calhoun counties, doing very well also compared to not only the national average, but the state of Michigan, I would say that they must have done some things right.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans, speaking with John Bison. He's the state representative for the 62nd State House District, which includes the cities of Battle Creek and Albion, as well as several townships in Calhoun County. Albion is one of the areas which has seen school consolidation come home. Their district is now basically been closed down. Students are going to Marshall instead. Going forward, what is the right way for the state to manage school closings, or perhaps to either encourage or discourage districts to close down?
I think there are incentives, and Marshall and Albion took advantage of those incentives that the state already has out there for the consolidation of school districts. Nobody likes seeing their school district closed or consolidated. When we talk about the Marshall Albion schools, as I like to refer to those schools, because now it's a combination of communities. It's not like Albion has completely lost its schools, but now they're governed from a little bit further away. And this is a model that was used previously in Buena Vista. This is a model that has been used previously in Inkster. And in all of those cases, the students are now going to better schools than they did originally. And I think that that is the right model moving forward. That's what is typically required under state law, that if you have such financial difficulties that you are considered to be insolvent or in risk of insolvent, if you cannot provide that quality program based upon the fiscal constraints that you have, then that consolidation is encouraged. And if it isn't done voluntarily, oftentimes the state will step in through the Department of Education and do that consolidation for you.
And I guess that's my question is, when do you think the threshold is crossed? You know, Albion, there was a vote, and the people there decided that they would, you know, move forward with consolidation.
It was an amazing vote. It was 75-80%. There was not just a majority. There was near consensus that this was the way that we needed to go.
But if a community doesn't vote that way, if there is resistance, where is that line, I guess, in your mind, that gets crossed where you think it's appropriate for the state to say, sorry, but this school district will have to close down?
This has to be all about the kids, Gordon. It can't be about bricks and mortar. It can't be about teachers. It can't be about the football team. It can't be about administration. And we need to get those kids into good systems. And if the schools that are providing services to these systems are not good, then they deserve to be closed down. And I think that you'll see that the state has made a major effort in trying to move in that direction here over the previous years by requiring that if you're on that list of lowest performing schools for 3 years in a row, then that's going to give you incentive to close. If you can't afford to fund your schools, that's going to give you incentives to close. And we have those incentives out there. If the people say we don't want those incentives, then in state law, the requirements are that the school board say that the district is insolvent. And if it decides that the district is insolvent, it comes upon the director of the independent school system to say, this is how we are going to take care of this problem. And he needs to come up with a plan to get those kids into good schools.
The state legislature passed a law, Governor Snyder signed it, that was going to remove the straight ticket option from ballots in November, but a federal judge overruled that. And so we will still be able to vote straight ticket in Michigan if we wish to. Is that a good thing?
In many ways, I would love to have a system where you could vote at your leisure, when you wanted to, and get a chance to really know who all of the candidates on the ballot are. And I am not for long lines. I would hate to see us disenfranchise voters. I think that voting is a necessary right of all of our people here in the state of Michigan.
So what about no reason absentee balloting? Wouldn't that provide part of what you're talking about, that you could take the ballot home, you could study it, you could Google candidates as you're going along, and more or less set up what you're talking about there, the time to examine each race?
And that's exactly what I would be very, very supportive of. I believe our last two secretaries of state have stated that they would be in favor of no reason absentee voting. I think it's an area that we have to move to in order to make this easy for our people so that they can really explore at their leisure the various candidates and make informed choices. And I think that it's incumbent upon our constituencies to make those informed choices.
John Bison, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
John Bison is the state representative for the 62nd State House District. He's running for re-election in the district, which includes the cities of Battle Creek and Albion, as well as several townships in Calhoun County. An interview has been scheduled with the Democratic candidate in the 62nd district, Jim Hodzma. That is set to run on Thursday's program. An interview with the Libertarian candidate in the 62nd district, Michelle Gregory, aired in September. A link can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.